Hi Medical Mums, welcome to today's episode of Medical Mums Chat. Today we will be speaking to Kim Matthews. She will be talking to us about having a child with autism and how it has inspired her to start a business providing support workers to families in the same situation. Kim is also talking to us about her IVF journey and the importance of community support and partnership. We hope you enjoy today's episode of Medical Mums Chat.
Tantrum on the floor for 40 minutes at a time, 3-4 times a day. Like, I had no idea what to do. It's a special kind of person who can come into your house and know how to deal with your young person. If I had known that somebody was coming every 3 weeks or once a month to come in and check on me at home, that would have been awesome.
Good morning, Medical Mums. Today we have a special guest with us. We have Kim. She's a partner of one of my really good friends who I work with, Dr. Joe. And we're here talking to her about her super interesting life and having kids and moving from Sydney to Queensland. Good morning, Kim, and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
So Kim, let's start with you telling Medical Mums a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I live in Queensland. I'm married to Dr. Joe. We've been married for 3 years, but we've been together for 11. We have 3 kids, 5.5 and 3.5-year-old twins. And I've just started my own business. Prior to that, I've been a train driver. I've been in the Navy. I've been various other things, but that's what I'm doing right now.
Excellent, excellent. Tell us a little bit about what business you're doing currently.
So the business I've started, it's called Sunshine Family Support, and it's basically, I'm kind of like an agency. I help families who are accessing the NDIS find the right support worker for their situation. So whether it's for an adult child who needs a companion or somebody to be with them, help with supporting education and employment, or more commonly, it's for parents of young children who need somebody to come in and be their second pair of hands or be the person who takes that child off to their therapies or just helps around the house or takes them out for an outing, that kind of thing. So that's what I do. I supply those support workers to those families.
And when did you start the business?
I just started it this year. Once my eldest was in prep, she started prep this year, and my twinnies are in pre-kindy 4 days a week, really. I just felt like it was time for me to re-enter the world because I'd been out of the workforce for, 5.5 years, nearly 6 years. And my entire adult life, I've always worked. I've never not worked. So it's been a really weird feeling being at home with the kids. And then moving from Sydney, where my career was as a train driver, up to Queensland, where I don't want to be a train driver anymore and the opportunity's gone anyway, I felt like I needed to do something.
So with this business, how did you get started and where do you actually find all your second parents, I suppose, if you want to call them to help?
Yeah, that's kind of, people would also sort of say big sister or big brother. So I got started because our eldest daughter was diagnosed with ASD when she was 3. Our twinnies were born when she was 2. So around that time, it was around the 18-month mark that I started noticing that things were a bit different with her, and everything just seemed harder. And by the time she was 2, we had employed an au pair who had a background in early childhood. That was her career back in Germany. And she really helped me to identify a couple of things about her daughter and also how to manage her, basically, because I had no idea. It's like, how do I manage this kid who's chucking a massive tantrum on the floor for 40 minutes at a time, 3-4 times a day? Like, I had no idea what to do. So we started there, and as time went on, we got the diagnosis, and then I started you know, delving into support workers, and you know, so I've been interviewing people and finding those right people basically from when my eldest was 2 years old, and I've just taken those kind of skills that I've developed and turned it into a business.
Wow. Now, certainly that, I remember certainly like during the early years, things were certainly a bit, you know, quite difficult for the two of you as a family. With negotiating with NDIS, how did you find that as a process?
Well, so the NDIS is super complicated. That's probably a whole other podcast.
But yeah.
So anybody can be a service provider really with the NDIS. You don't have to be registered with the NDIS. I'm not registered with them, but I'm in the process of being, yes, because I think, I feel like personally that's the writing on the wall. That's what's going to happen in the future. They're going to require all service providers to be registered, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm getting prepared for that. But as it stands right now, literally anyone can be a support worker. So that has its benefits as well as its downside, as you can imagine, because it's a special kind of person who can come into your house and know how to deal with your young person who's got whatever the disability is. Just because you think you can do it doesn't mean that you can do it.
Yeah, true. And when you interview for support workers, I mean, what are you actually looking for?
So I'm looking for not necessarily qualifications. That's nice, but anyone can go and get a certificate 3 in disability or individual support. It doesn't mean that you're suited to the work. So that's good to have. And also for my particular purpose, background in early childhood is also good. So if you have a cert 3 in early childhood or more, that's great. But usually what I look for is somebody who has the passion, the genuine desire to do the work and make it a long-term career, the experience. So whether they've got lived experience, like with a family member, or that they've just been doing it for a while. So one of the questions I always ask is, have you experienced a meltdown with a child? And like, what
looks
like?
And very important.
How do you manage that? And the answers are really important as to whether they go forward or not.
Yeah, that's very true. And so obviously it's only been a couple of months since you started. How many people have you got working for you now?
I've got 4 regular workers working right now for the company. But once I get registered with the NDIS, I'm hoping to grow that you know, to a larger number. At the moment, I'm just doing like Sunshine Coast, you know, up to Noosa and kind of down to Caloundra area, but I want to grow that from sort of up to Gympie and down to Gold Coast.
And are you finding that there is enough work for your workers at the moment?
Yeah, most people don't want to do 40 hours a week because it is demanding. Most people want to have part-time work.
Yeah,
so it's perfect for that.
Okay, okay. And how do families generally contact you? Because you're still quite a new business.
Yeah, so they find me on Facebook. I'm part of a lot of local groups. So I try to be active in those groups, put myself forward. I've got quite a good social media person working for me as well.
Oh, so, great.
Because I know very little about social media. I'm too old now. So she runs my...
40 is hardly old, Kim.
It's old in terms of like Snapchat and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Even Instagram, I don't know.
Yeah,
so she kind of... she runs that for me, and that's been really successful, just getting some videos out about what we do and some profiles of some of the workers that we have available. So I find that's been really beneficial. But also word of mouth and connecting with support coordinators and plan managers, that helps as well.
And so obviously, because this is not part of the NDIS yet, where do families get funding to access services?
So depending on how you manage your funds, so say your child has an NDIS package, you can opt to have the NDIS manage it for you, a plan manager manage it for you, or you can manage it yourself. So if you manage it yourself or plan manager, then you can access whoever you want, really.
Okay. Is this geared towards any child with any level of disability?
Yeah, look, I don't, at the moment, I don't really service kids with high level medical needs, because that's not really, that's not what I know about personally. My
right.
experience is kids with ASD, ADHD, oppositional defiance disorder, that kind of thing. And there's, I just found there's plenty.
So more neurodiversity rather than physical diversity.
That's
at
right,
this point.
Yeah. I'm not saying that we won't ever do that. I'd like to branch out, but we're just starting with what we know best first.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough.
You know, and I've been able to connect with families really well over that because we have common experiences all the way through.
For young parents, obviously starting out with neurodiverse children, are there specific resources or websites you can recommend for them to start and then go from there?
There's lots of good resources. It just depends on which state you're in. Autism is a bit of a funny thing. There's a couple of schools of thought on that, and it's kind of some people think this and some people think that. So the kids Raising Kids Network has some great links. So if you go to raisingkidsnetwork.net.au, I think it is, there's some good links there. Starting with your GP is really good because they can give you, there's a package where you get 5 allied health
Like a, what do
sessions.
you call
What's it called?
that? A care plan?
Care plan. Yeah, and so you can take that and you can go and see a speechy or an OT, and that's usually the best place to start. A speechy or an OT who has an interest in children, neurodiverse children, and they'll let you know if there needs to be further steps.
And are you loving it at this point?
Yeah, it's
Like
really
is
good. Like, it's good to be back in contact with adults. But also, I really like helping people. So, after I'd finished my training career, I had started, well, I was halfway through a human services degree because I thought, oh, I'd really like to do social work one day, but the placement's just, I can't do it with the kids. It's just not possible. So, I started that thinking, oh, I'll turn that into something. I'll go into social services somehow. And then this year, I just thought, oh, I'm not going to spend 2 more years studying full time and not really achieving very much when I have something that I can do right now. And so I think that was the right decision.
I think there certainly is paucity of services when it comes to helping parents because, having dealt with the NDIS, with work, while they're a great organisation, I think resources are scarce and it's very difficult. And I think having people like yourself offering an alternate service is actually really, really good.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a niche, because I've spoken to lots of families where they've either been put off by the initial kind of, they've put themselves out there saying, listen, we need a support worker, and then they've been inundated with all these people, and then they're having to try and weed through that, and they don't know really what they're looking for even, and then they're put off totally, and they don't really know what to do with the funding that they've been given, and sometimes they're scared to use it because they're scared that the NDIS is going to come back and, wrap them on the knuckles or something. So yeah, having someone to come into their house and sit with them and talk about the situation and say, yeah, listen, you can use your funding for this and that, it has been helpful for some families, I think.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be. It's just one less thing to worry about, I suppose,
Oh, for sure.
on
Even
top of
finding,
everything.
for myself, interviewing the support workers that I'm going to have in the business is a very long process. And I have so many people applying, and probably out of 20 applicants, I might get one who's awesome.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
But that's
that's
the
fair enough.
that I think it just indicates the number of people who are trying to get into the sector.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was your varied career throughout your life, which I found, I personally find quite interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I guess I didn't have a straight path like probably most people who enter medicine have
I know,
with a
we're really boring. High school,
yeah.
university
Boring and
work.
impressive. It's a long haul, but I didn't sort of end up doing anything like that. So I went to probably one of the worst schools in New South Wales for high school. I'm the first person in my family, including my parents, to finish high school. I started thinking about university, but the marks I got were, I couldn't really do anything. I didn't know what I wanted to do anyway. So I left my small town as soon as I could and did a little bit of work, and then I joined the Navy. So I did that for a while.
How long were you in the Navy?
I actually was in it twice. So I joined when I was 20, I think. And I started out, and then I just wasn't sure, and it was all very restrictive. And so I did that for about a year, and I just thought, no, I've got to get out of this. So I left and I went and did a little bit of travel and did a few other kind of nondescript jobs, lived in Sydney, partied, that kind of thing. And then I just thought, oh, I'm not really going anywhere. Actually, that was a pretty good career. So I managed to get back in, doing the same job that I had started to train for. So that was great. The second time around, I went at it 100%, and I did really well and achieved really highly, and I was really suited to it. It was fantastic. And then when I got to sea, I discovered that I have chronic
Oh
seasickness.
my God,
Yeah.
okay.
I think these days they test that out in recruit school, but back then they didn't.
And what were you training for in the Navy?
So I was training to be, and I ended up being a combat systems operator, which anybody who's actually been in the Navy would be like, oh my God.
Sounds impressive.
It sounds really impressive, but it's shift work. You're in the operations room, which is all dark. It's really exciting and everything. It's the kind of the hub of the war center.
Yeah.
If you like. You're dealing with radars and sonars and all the interesting stuff. But yeah, it's shift work. So you're up kind of all night.
And how long were you in there the second time around?
The second time around I was in for 3 years. And I had to make a decision. I was either going to stay in, and they tried to sort of get me to, you know, find an interest in submarines, and I really didn't want to.
Submarines? Did you end up working on one?
No, I went down on a little jaunt one day with about 10 other people from my ship that I was on at that time to have a look, and it was fine, but I mean, that's a whole other story. It's so complicated and so competitive to get into submarines. I think if you're not interested, then there's no point, and I wasn't interested. So
I think I'd feel so claustrophobic.
Yeah, it was a bit. That didn't really bother me, though. I was saying to Jo the other day, she was asking about it too, and I said it wasn't that that bothered me. The thing that bothered me was having to learn everyone else's job as a just in case something happens to the bloke who runs the electrics.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
All that stuff. And so I just thought, oh, no, that's not for me. So I had to make the decision to get out, and they made it really difficult for me. I tried to transfer to the RAF, obviously, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
So I could be not at sea.
Yeah.
And they just wouldn't help me. They didn't like that I had kind of said, no, this is not for me. And as I was leaving, I remember this officer said to me, you'll never make this money again. So I was like, oh, thanks for that. And I immediately started an office job making that same money. So, yeah.
And how did you find, obviously 20 odd years ago, I think, you know, like gender equality and things are not as up to scratch as it is these days.
Yeah.
Being in the Navy and or the Army.
Yeah, know? I think it's probably changed a lot. When I joined, when I was much younger, there was a lot of misogyny and sexism.
Mm.
I remember really clearly a couple of incidents that happened when I was in recruit school with girls who are much younger than me, because you can join, I think, when you're 16 or 17. And these girls that I'm thinking were 17 and I was, what, 20.
Mm.
And this yuck old guy who must have been close to retirement just making these really sexualized comments to these girls just in front of everybody. No issue. But it definitely has changed these days. You would not get away with that. I can't imagine.
Yeah, and was it something that had continued throughout your career in the Navy?
Not for me, because I've worked in a lot of male-dominated industries, and I think being gay kind of gives you the backstage pass to the boys' club, because they just look at you as one of the boys. So I've been privy to a lot of conversations behind the scenes with guys, and where I've been shocked, because in front of other women, they're different men. I'm not saying all guys are like this, but I've certainly come across this situation a lot, where the way that they speak about women is just unbelievable. But you're taken into that group.
So there was it the same amount of discrimination you get being gay as being a woman?
No, I feel like being gay, I was afforded more kind of respect, if you like, because I was one of the boys.
Yeah.
So I never had any kind of sexual harassment or anything like that happened to me. But I certainly saw other women who were probably, you know, more overtly feminine. That was just assumed that they were dumb, basically.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, certainly things still happen like that, but I think a lot of people are getting called out.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
A lot more.
It was a different time.
Yeah. And then after leaving the Navy, when did you start the train driving? Because I find that quite fascinating as well.
It's such a random thing. So after I left the Navy, I was working as a contractor for a company that services the Navy ships down at Garden Island. And I was looking around, and I had really wanted to join the RAF, because the job I was doing kind of roughly translated across to a job that I could have done in the RAF, and I could have, you know, gone one step further and tried to be an officer, which that's what I wanted to do. And so I walked into the recruiting office one day and explained the situation, and they said, "Oh, you should have been directly transferred." And I was like, "Are you serious?" Because I really tried hard, and they really didn't help me at all. So I was pretty pissed off about that. So then I started that process to try and join for that job. And at the same time, I thought, oh, the AFP advertised for agents, basically. So I thought, oh, I'll give that a go as well. So I put an application in for that. And then randomly a friend sent to me from seek.com.au, "Haha, this train driver job, you should apply for it." And so I did. And it was like fast forward about 6 months or something, or maybe even longer, a year. I get this email about the train job. And in the same week, I was offered all of those three jobs, and I had to make a decision because I'd been working my way through with the AFP doing the fitness tests and all of that, staying in the RAF. And it got to the point where I had to make a decision. And for some reason, I just chose the train job. I don't know why.
Because it would have been shift work again as well, wouldn't it? Yeah.
So I think all three jobs would have involved some shift work. But yeah, I don't know what it was. I just chose the train job and started. And lucky I did, because if I hadn't have done that, I would never have met Joe, and I wouldn't have.
So how long were you with the transport company then?
Almost 10 years.
10 years?
Yeah. So I was working for about 5 years, and then I've only recently resigned because I had maternity leave for 2 years and then fell pregnant at the end of that, and then it had maternity leave for a further 2 years. I've only just kind of resigned the last 12 months.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. But then you haven't driven since you moved up here?
No. I haven't worked for them since I moved up here. But I just wanted to, you know, moving to Queensland from Sydney was a big move, and I just wanted to keep that door open.
Just in case.
Just in case, yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. So then you obviously met the lovely Jo, and then she carted you all the way up here for work.
Well, I carted here, actually.
Really? Yeah. I thought she came up here for work and training.
I mean, she did, but I had to convince her. I had to really campaign for a long time about the idea of leaving Sydney.
Uh-huh.
She was very nervous to leave our kind of queer community.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. And how did you find moving up here then? Starting over again.
Yeah, I didn't care. I wasn't fazed at all. I was just happy to be out of Sydney because I was so sick of the congestion and the noise.
Mm.
And, you know, we had Asha by that stage, our eldest daughter, and she was 8 months when we moved. And I could just see that we weren't going to be able to do the things for her that I wanted to do for her.
Mm.
And lucky we did, because, you know, once she got her diagnosis, I realised what an absolute nightmare it would have been in Sydney trying to do anything. But up here, you know, at the time when she was diagnosed, we had our pick of specialists. There was, you know, very few waiting lists for any of the allied health professionals.
Mm.
A bit different now, but yeah, everything was easy.
And when you came up here, because I know you're part of the Rainbow Families group, was it something you started?
It was already... A lady called Marion started it, but she hadn't had much success. She didn't have a lot of time. She has young children as well. And so I got in touch with her to say, hey, you know, what's happening with this thing? So we worked together for a little bit to try and get it going. And then another woman came from Sydney who had a bit of an activist background, and she was quite involved in some stuff in Sydney, and she really got it kick-started up here.
Okay. And so for those who are not aware, tell us about Rainbow Families.
So Rainbow Families is, people think, oh, there's a head office for Rainbow Family somewhere. There's not. It's just a community-run group that is anywhere it needs to be. So there's, you know, plenty of branches in Sydney and Melbourne. But basically it's just a community-run group for queer families. We've had plenty of families who have joined who have kids who are identifying as, you know, gender non-conforming or, you know, gay or lesbian or whatever. So... there's a big mix of people who join for lots of reasons, and it's a really good community that we've got up here. People are always surprised when I tell them we've got, I think, around 300 members.
Mm.
So I guess that's 300 families in the area. Yeah. Yeah. But there's members who are wanting to fall pregnant and trying to fall pregnant, or, you know, trying to start their family, whichever way they're going to do it. They're absolutely welcome. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. No, that's really good. And how often do you guys meet up, and what do you guys do?
We were meeting up once a month for ages, and then I got really busy with, you know, my own kids and our stuff.
Mm.
So we haven't had lots of meetings recently.
That's and I think COVID happened as well.
COVID happened, and then summertime's really hard too because people who have young kids, like babies, they don't want to come out. And if they've got an older kid and a baby, then they're not going to come because it's just too hot to have the baby out at the event. So winter time's probably our time, but I need some other people to kind of come on board as admins to get that started again.
And if they want to get involved, do we get in touch with you just through Facebook? Is there
through Facebook. It's Rainbow Families Sunshine Coast or Sunshine Coast Rainbow Families. I can't remember.
Yeah, one of those. Okay. Okay, no, that's really good. So after having Asha, obviously then the decision was made to have more children. Yeah. I mean, are you happy to talk about your IVF journey with Meek Mums? Because obviously we do have families that go through IVF.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of people do.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we decided that we wanted to have children. And I always thought either that I would not have children or that my girlfriend would be the one to have the children. And then when I met Jo, I was like, it's going to have to be me. Like, that was really clear. So I wasn't overly excited about being pregnant. But then when I was pregnant, I was like, oh, wow, this is a very, wonderful and exciting and special experience. I was more than happy. I don't know what I thought it was going to be like, but it was...
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where you don't really know what it's like until it happens to you.
Yeah, yeah. I had all these ideas about it. And in the end, it was just wonderful. So wonderful that I decided to do it again.
And then had twins.
Yeah. So, yeah, the IVF was a bit of a long journey, but not as long as some people. I think in total we went through 4 IVF cycles and I don't know how many transfers, probably 15 transfers or something like that. It took us 18 months to fall pregnant with Asha, and in that time I had a miscarriage as well. So that was, that was pretty traumatic, but we kind of took a month off and then got back to it, and then had Asha. And yeah, then we moved up here, and around that time we just sort of said, well, if we're going to do it, we need to get cracking, because if it takes another 18 months or longer, we need to leave ourselves a bit of time. And then we had one transfer that failed, and then we had we had this embryo that we'd carried around from our very first clinic. So we ended up with 3 clinics that we tried in total.
Yeah.
So our very first clinic carried around this embryo that had been grown out to 3 days, and then I went under another egg retrieval, and we got 1 egg. And I said to the fertility specialist, can we grow that one out to 5 days? Because we were going to grow the new egg out to 5 days. Can we just grow it up to 5 days and just see how we go? And so on the day of transfer, the scientist kept poking her head around the door and she's like, it's looking really good. I just want you to know that both eggs are looking really good. Both embryos are looking really good. I was like, yeah, that's okay. She's like, are you sure you want to put them both in? And then the fertility specialist was like, are you sure? So they must have asked me about 5 times. And Jo wasn't even there because we've been through it so many times.
Mm.
She just said, do whatever you think is right.
Yeah.
That's really helpful. So yeah, let's just do it. And,
Both took,
yeah. And it's funny because I don't know now which one of the twins is the embryo that's older than my oldest daughter.
Oh, yeah, true. That's right. And, I mean, did you find it quite difficult, looking for donors? Or did you not have to do that?
No, I didn't have to do that. We didn't have to go through that. We started out and we asked Joe's brother if he would mind being our donor. But we did that thinking, we'll just cross that off. We just expected him to say no, but we thought, we'll just ask, because for us that would be a perfect situation. And he said yes, and he was completely excited to,
oh, that's great,
to be a part of it. So that's what we did. So that's why the kids also look a bit like Joe.
Yeah, no, that's actually really good. Because I know people who are trying, who's just having a really hard time with donors, and I don't know what the situation is like currently in Australia for that, so... Yeah, it's a bit hard, I think.
I think it's hard. I think some people go through, Facebook groups where guys are happy to be, anonymous donors, and then other people go through their fertility clinic and they access donor sperm from the US. And
I know people who've done that as well.
Yeah,
had to go overseas for it. And did you find it mentally, quite taxing?
Yeah, in the end I did. Yeah, it was. Because I learned very quickly that I wish that I hadn't told people that we were going through IVF at the beginning, because then everyone's kind of like, they want to know, like, what's happening? Has it taken? Are you pregnant? And month after month, that takes a toll, having to kind of give answers. And I think after, particularly after a miscarriage, I didn't tell anyone after that that we were trying.
If someone, let's say, were to go through IVF, I mean, would you, do you have advice on, you know, looking back of it retrospectively, you know, getting people involved earlier or certain specialties involved earlier?
IVF, I don't know. It's one of those necessary evils, I feel like. I think at all clinics that we went to, the three of them, we felt like a number, really, just in different ways. Particularly at the first clinic we went to, I just felt like we were a number. They didn't care. They were just going through the motions and taking our money. That's what it felt like.
Because it is quite expensive,
isn't
it?
It's really expensive.
Medicare doesn't really cover very much, do they? Yeah.
I think it cost us, I don't know, about $100,000 all up by the time we'd finished.
Wow.
With the three kids. Yeah. We got a bit back here and there, I think. But, yeah. Luckily, we were able to do it. And we prepared, like, you know, in the first few years that we were together, we were not really big partiers. I did all that in my 20s. And so once I'd met Joe when I was 30, you know, we were just working and doing a little bit of travel and stuff and saving our money, luckily.
Mm. Yeah. And what about, you know, counselling and getting your GP involved earlier or more?
I think probably counselling could play a bigger role. You know, you do the obligatory counselling with your fertility clinic to make sure that everyone's on the same page pretty much.
And is that with like a proper counsellor or just
with... Yeah, that's with a psychologist.
Right, okay.
So yeah, they do that, but I think what would be useful is, would be to have some ongoing counselling or psychology involvement the whole way through, because it can be a really long process. And then I think most people who've been through IVF, where it's taken a little bit longer than they expected, they realise like, oh, if I have to draw a line somewhere, where is that line? Because I always felt like, oh, it could be the next time might be the time. And when you're paying at $10,000 a time, like, wow,
where do you stop?
yeah
because it can certainly take a toll on you, both financially and physically, emotionally, mentally.
I saw women putting across multiple credit cards, you know, at times when I was in the waiting room, you know, just maxing out one and pulling out the next one. I just thought, wow, there's no guarantees here.
That's hard, isn't it? Yeah, because I also know people who've tried IVF who've failed but have drawn the line and not gone back to do it again. So
yeah, we were at that point as we were falling pregnant with Asha, thank goodness.
Yeah. Mm. Did you find, you know, sort of more support being around friends and family in Sydney going through IVF? Or because you did your second cycle up here, didn't it?
So it was actually really funny. We went through it and a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, said, oh, I just want to tell you that, you know, my girlfriend, my wife and I are going to try. Can you give me any advice? And like, I know how long it's taken for you. What do you think? And I just said, oh, look, if you're thinking about it, just do it, because who knows how long it's going to take. And then we fell pregnant at the same time.
Mm.
And she kind of came to me and she's like, I'm pregnant. You told me this was going to take a lot longer. I don't know if we're ready. I was like, oh, sorry, but that's wonderful. So we had our kids 9 days apart. And then another friend just happened to be going through it as well, that we didn't know about. So we all had our babies within 2 months of each other, within a month of each other. And so we had our built-in little support network for the whole pregnancy. And then for the 8 months that we were in Sydney, we all lived like 200 metres from each other. So we had built-in everything, which was fantastic.
Yeah, that's good.
I don't know how it would have been if I hadn't had that support network. Just, it was so solid because we knew each other so well.
Because you got pregnant the second time here. With the twins.
With the twins here, I got pregnant up here, yeah.
Yeah, and how did you find that without having...
That was really hard.
Support.
Yeah, it was a lot harder. I'd made some connections in the community, but with a twin pregnancy for me, it was like really hard on my body. And I had, was it perinatal depression?
Mm.
Yeah, I had perinatal depression. It took me a while to sort of figure that out. So I was trying to deal with that. and we didn't really have a solid support network of our, you know, our.
Was support offered as part of the IVF consult?
Yeah, look,
like a group you could join, or
yeah, and I did reach out to my specialist, and she was really good, and then I connected with a psychologist. Yeah, so that's really good, and she specialises in you know, women's health, pregnancy, loss of pregnancy, all that stuff. That's her area of expertise, so she's fantastic. But it was still really hard, and then that sort of turned into a bit of postnatal depression. But it's hard to separate the two because twins, no sleep,
everything was just happening
ASD,
at the same time.
Toddler roaming around, like, it was really hard.
How do you think, I guess, us as medical professionals can make it easier for patients going through things like IVF and difficult pregnancies to access support?
I think what would
or to
been,
offer support, I mean.
Yeah, to offer support. I think if there's some way where you can not wait for the patient to come to you, if you can reach out to the patient, if you have a...
So being more proactive about it.
Yeah, if you're seeing someone and supporting them during their pregnancy, to reach out to them and check how they're going in between appointments and maybe recommend, you know, some external help, a counsellor.
Do you think there's enough services out there for these sort of things?
I know there's plenty of services on the coast. I just don't know if they're all working together effectively in that way, where it's sort of, it's not waiting for the mum to get to the point where she's so beside herself that she's going to reach out somehow, hopefully, but getting in there and checking that she's okay all the way through, just like you do with checking the baby all the way through.
Mm. Because I know another medical mum in Melbourne who started this initiative where she and a few GPs actually go out to see perinatal patients.
Yeah.
So I think something like that could be a goal, I think, for
a lot of
difficult pregnancies and IVF pregnancies
around
Australia, and actually offering that service proactively, like you said, rather than wait for people to come to you when they have a problem.
Yeah, I would have found that really useful if I had known that somebody was coming every 3 weeks or once a month to come in and check on me at home, that would have been awesome.
So we just need to make services more accessible, I suppose.
I think so.
Yeah, with these sort of things. And so with you know, the perinatal depression, how did you work around that or work with it?
I just kept going. I'm not particularly prone to depression and that kind of mental health stuff. I think I'm pretty resilient around that. So I was able to just push through. But I think if I'd had, you know, previous kind of bouts of depression and stuff like that, I don't know what it would have happened.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Because it's the caring for the toddler as well. And when I think with a twin pregnancy, I was so uncomfortable. Like, I could hardly move. And then also dealing with looking after Asha and giving her what she needed. I remember the day our au pair arrived, and it was 2 months before I had the babies. And I remember thinking to myself, as she came to the door, I literally could not have done another day. Like, she got there just in the nick of time.
So what I'm hearing is support is key, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Even just like an extra hand to do whatever it is it needs doing around the house.
Just an extra person to talk to, because Joe was working full time at that. And you know what it's like at the hospital. Like, you can finish at 4, but you're not, might not be home till 6.
Yeah.
Depending on whatever happens. So, yeah, just having that extra adult in the house as well was really, really good.
Mm. Yeah, I think certainly what I miss sometimes is having adult conversations with people when you have young kids at home, you know.
Yeah.
Or even watching adult TV, I find.
Yeah.
I just have cartoons all the time playing on the loop in the background. So I guess this is tied back in with what services you offer with your company.
Kind of. So I've found when I'm talking to families, so usually we're connecting online, and I'll get an email or a message in my, you know, business Facebook thing, and I'll arrange a phone call with that. Usually it's mum, and she'll just talk, and I'll listen for like an hour, and she'll tell me everything that's happening. And most of the time I can be saying like, yep, yeah, I know what that's like. Yeah, I've gone through that, or, you know, we're going through that at the moment. It's really difficult. And I can it's almost every single time, and I can see that they just literally have no one to talk to and have become isolated. A lot of the time the partner's working away or they're no longer together for lots of reasons. So it's really, really common that it's mum at home isolated and like beside herself.
Do you think you'd add mental health services to your company at some point?
I'd really like to add some allied health, like, you know, looking long term, I'd love to have a speech pathologist on board and an occupational therapist and a psychologist.
Mm.
Yep, that's the goal. Yeah.
I think this is a really, really great initiative. Certainly should be publicized more.
Well, you know? I've been offered an interview on ABC.
You should do it.
I know, but I was so nervous. So actually,
you can use this as a practice.
This is a practice. That's exactly what I thought when you asked me to come and talk to you. I was like, oh, this will be good practice to go in. And I know the woman. It's so funny. I know the woman. It's not like it's a total stranger.
It's something that I think there is a genuine need and people will actually benefit from it.
I think so.
It's not woo. You know?
No, it's really needed. And I always think back to that time when it was so, so hard and Julia, our au pair, arrived. And I always think back to how hard that was. And I know that there are mums that I speak to every week who are going through that same feeling. So it does feel like I'm doing something important. Whether or not I'm ever going to make $1 million, I don't really care.
Mm. See, and I think that's also a crux. When you start a business because you care and you want to make a difference and it's not about money, I think businesses like that will grow organically because people will see that it is, A, it's a need that you're meeting, and B, you're actually meeting it with genuine concerns. You're not coming from I need to meet KPIs or make money from it.
I think that's what some people find about agencies in general, because there are plenty of agencies that supply support workers, plenty. But what the participants find is that they'll just send them anybody. They don't care. They just send the body out to make the money for those hours and bring them back. And they can send a different person every day. They really don't care.
Mm.
And that's no good, particularly for people who are on the spectrum. They need that routine. But anybody, you know, you don't want a different person coming into your home, you know, three times a week. You want to build a relationship with that person.
Correct.
So they get to know you.
Yeah, I think that's really quite important as well with neurodiverse children and adults, having some sort of solid support and like continuity.
Right. Well, that's when you can build a really, you know, solid trusting relationship, and that's where the window opens a little bit for you to make some difference. That's what I found with my kids anyway. The more they trust, and sometimes, you know, my eldest will be having a meltdown and the support worker will say, oh, I don't know what happened. I'm like, well, it's okay, because this is happening because she trusts you.
Mm.
Like, if you think back to the first 2 months where you were here, this didn't happen because she was still kind of on guard a little bit, but now she feels totally comfortable. So it's not a bad thing. Yeah.
Okay. No, that's actually good. Lastly, how's everything going then with family and life, and is everything, you know, settling down now that the kids are in school, you've got your own business, happy, things are going well?
I feel like I've entered that phase of, like, that middle-aged phase of life.
Oh, my God, you keep calling yourself old. We're, like, the same age.
Not old, but, like, you know, that middle area of your life, I think, where women have got, like, you know, if you're lucky, which I feel I am lucky, you've got a bit of financial security, you've got a bit of life experience, and you know yourself a little bit better. So I feel like I'm coming into that time of my life where I know what I want to do. I've got the means to do it, and I've got the drive to do it. So I'm very happy with where this has all ended up. The kids are happy. Ash is happy at school. So that's all we can ask for. She's thriving in prep. So that's fantastic. Because I know that some families go through school refusal and that kind of thing, which is really hard. So we feel really fortunate that she's happy there. And the twinnies are happy in their pre-kindy. So, and Jo's happy at her work.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. Well, thank you very much, Kim, for opening up, telling us your story, because, you know, it's not always easy, I suppose. Yeah, so this concludes our episode, Medical Mums, and we will chat to you next time. That concludes today's episode of Medical Mums Chat. We hope you enjoyed listening to Kim's story. If you have a story you want to tell, please let us know. In the meantime, look after yourself and each other, and we'll see you on the next episode.